is a podcast recording of The Nature of Things. This podcast was initially recorded June 10th, 1993.
What is it that motivates the lifelong interests of people? Why is one fascinated with history while another finds it totally irrelevant? For me, I believe the pivotal experience, the motivator of a lifelong fascination, was a robin's nest filled with sky blue eggs and located on the tongue of a hay wagon, where even a five-year-old could see it. From then on, I saw birds in a new light, and before I was out of the elementary school, I was searching, researching, and collecting already used nests. How or why my mother put up with it, I don't know, but she did, helping with the research and figuring ways to preserve the nest without totally destroying the decorum of the home. All of my family was supportive of my natural history bent. After all, Mom and Dad were themselves nature lovers. My father commuted 35 miles one way to a studio in Rochester so that his family could enjoy the benefits of a life on the farm. It's almost 65 years since that first robin's nest, and my zeal hasn't flagged much since. Most memorable for me was my sabbatic year at Oswego, when I fulfilled my professional requirement right at home by an in-depth study of nesting in a gifted wetland, the like of which I've never seen elsewhere. Just a few miles west of the Oswego campus was a 20-acre wetland where in 1 year over 200 nests of a dozen species of birds were shoehorned into the 15 acres of reeds and bushes and 5 acres of open water. In case you're not a devotee of numbers, let me point out that it means 20 nests per acre, an average of a 20-foot by 20-foot plot for each nesting female. You might wonder how a bird could nourish its voracious young ones in such restrictive quarters. Before I found this lavishly endowed wetland apartment complex, I would have vowed it could not be done. That year, after banding dozens of red-winged blackbirds nestlings, equal numbers of moorhen, least bittern, and Virginia rail chicks, and over 200 week-old black tern chicks, I had gained some new insights on the mechanisms at work. First, the wetland involved was fabulously rich, choked with very vegetation, and so endowed with aquatic life that every dip with the net produced dozens of aquatic insects, amphibians, and minnows. Aerial insects were sometimes annoyingly thick, but strangely enough, the biting kind were scarce. Food was plentiful here. Then, there was the depth and thickness of the emergent cover, including 10 to 12-foot cattails, 3 to 4-foot burweeds and bulrushes, along with a healthy scattering of buttonbush, willow, and silky cornel. Imagine an apartment building as big as 3 football fields. That's enough floor space for 500 ample apartments. For the birds, the reeds and rushes and 18-inch deep water provided several levels or stories for nesting. Next, there is the sequential nature of the nesting. 85 productive redwing nests distributed over 3.5 months boils down to less than 30 at a time. Meanwhile, black terns, though somewhat less sequenced, were each spending just over 3 weeks in incubation before their young assaulted the food supply. By then, the many redwings were foraging at some distance from the home wetland. The last factor assuring success in such conditions might be reduced to the concept of role-playing or division of labor. It's possible for redwings, moorhens, least bitterns, and black terns to nest within a few feet of each other with minimal strife and competition. The redwings nest in the cattails, burweeds, and buttonbush, and forage most for weed seeds and aerial insects. Least bitterns nest in similar sites, but a large percentage of their food consists of small amphibians, insect nymphs, and minnows plucked from the water. Moorhens nest at the base of the rushes and feed on mollusks, vegetation, seeds, and insects. The tern nests are more open situations. Their nest right in the water level. Nesting success in bird world seldom exceeds 50% of the potential. Interesting, isn't it, that this colonial living in nature can work despite the crowding, whereas civilized man forced into the same kind of crowding becomes notably uncivil, especially when lifestyles are different or clannish. The lessons here is not one of morality. Nature has no moral structure, neither does it suffer from moral indignation or judgmentalism. Within species, strife is frequent, but it is never settled in court. Between species, strife is functional and essential to success. Wild things fulfill their roles without apparent lust for the position or for the roles of others. Maybe sociologists and politicians should study wetland communities. Maybe we all should. Well, that's all I have for today. This is John Weeks saying thanks for listening. Tune in next week and keep it natural.